D-E-M-O. Democratic? Mm. Democrats? C-A-N-I. Candidates. Democratic candidates. Mm. S-A-C-T. Actually. R E A reading R E A D read read your platform.
Wow.
This was early in the campaign and did said they said this is it.
Yeah. Did they adopt any of it? I mean, did they actually
did always after the election. No, after he D dropped out. He was he was running himself. This is when there were a gazillion people running.
Oh, right, 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 right.
And he read that after he had dropped out.
Ah, I see.
Yeah.
Well, that's great, though. That you know, you never know. You do something, you write something, you say something. You never know what the effect is going to be. You just never do. And that's why you have to keep doing it, in my opinion.
Yes. And it is an now, N-O, non, it's non-linear how it happened.
Right, exactly, exactly. Yeah. Well, that's, of course, like, that's, of course, like the viral stuff, internet viral stuff. It's non-linear. It just goes, you never know where something's going to end up. And if you put something out, where it's going to, who's going to be watching or listening.
Yes.
It's amazing, actually.
You did you, why? U, P, Yippee, would, were, my, R, O, role models.
Oh, yeah. Cool. That's not very nice to know.
And the T H R O W throwing
the money at the stock exchange? Yeah. Well, you know, when Bernanke and all of them were throwing money at the corporations, I said, they were not the first ones to do this. We were the first ones to do this. We brought the stock exchange to a halt, and they infused money in it to make it keep going. Mm-hmm. That was the big difference, of course. And we only spent $250, and they spent billions. Mm-hmm. But, you know, apart from those minor differences, we were essentially doing the same thing.
And they, J, H, A, had to P I P U put G L A glass
up afterwards, exactly. Well, I don't know if you know the true story, but the true story is that everybody went up to the stock exchange, and there was a guard there. This is before they put the glass, and there was a guard there. And the guard said to Abby, well, we're not going to let you in. No, 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 you can't come in. And Abby said to the guard, the only reason you're not letting us in is because we're Jewish. And so then the guard backed down, and that's how got in. And then, you know, throwing the money over, and it was not very much. It was in dollar bills, but it didn't last very long. So then we start to dig the change out of our pockets and throw that. And down on the floor, the stockbrokers, they just dropped everything, and they were grabbing for this money as it came down from the balcony. And then he's right. After that, they put up a glass partition so that no one could come and do this again. It was amazing.
Cool. One of the most effective P pranks.
That and levitating the Pentagon. I mean, apart from Chicago 68, which was, you know, beyond prank. But levitating the Pentagon was actually a one. I wasn't there for that, but I've heard many, many stories about it. And it was a wonderful event because who knows that it didn't happen? Mm-hmm. You know, 6 feet, it was an evil, evil structure. We exorcised the evil out of the structure, and it levitated 6 feet off the ground. That was our goal, and I believe we accomplished it.
At the S.A. at the same time, I don't, I had, I-W-E, I went in to the M-A-R Marines Recruiting Office in on campus, and I wanted to enlist.
Yeah.
And he was acting very eager, and he was ready to go. He was in like with his board and pointer
right.
on.
Right. And so
they did not know if I was serious. They T.R. tried to E.X.P. explain I was not
eligible.
What? They were looking for. I.
That's a real yippee act. It's a total yippee act.
I, J, just would, could, not get it. I said, I can P-U push. I can push the button.
That's right.
They G-O. They got it at that point.
They did, huh?
Yeah.
That's, I'm really glad you did that. I think that's just a wonderful thing to have done. It's just fabulous. Yeah. It's,
One of my one of my first performances.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. And a very, like I said, a very yippee thing to do. A very yippee thing to do. It sort of puts the contradictions right up front. It's great. It's great.
How did you B-R-E become a L I F life long Y no T R O troublemaker.
How did I become? I was always a troublemaker. I have always been rebellious. I don't know why. I don't have a. I mean, there are many people who try to explain it. And I, being a troublemaker, I reject all those explanations. But I think I've always had a lifelong sense of injustice, whether it's personal, things that are done to me personally or my close family and associates or people who I care about or the world or oppressed groups of any type. And I just, I came to Berkeley in 1968, which is a really good year to come here. And I met Stu at a Stop the Draft Week, my late husband Stu Albert, at a Stop the Draft Week demonstration. And I was just very motivated to push up against the things that were going on. And luckily for me, Stu's best friends were Eldridge Cleaver and Jerry Rubin. And so through them, I got to meet the Yippies. We went to Chicago, and we actually lived in New York while we were organizing for the Chicago demonstrations. We lived actually in a cellar on Bleecker Street, and it was the only cool place in town. So Jerry would come, and Jerry and Nancy would come, Abby and Anita would come. Jerry was living on St. Mark's Place. Abby and Anita were living across the road, but they would come to our cellar because it was the only cool place where we could have meetings. And it was underneath Liberty House, which was a collective of women from the South, and this was a store that was selling goods made by this collective of women. So we were all there meeting and talking about Chicago, and then we all went to Chicago. And so, the troublemaking just kind of escalated the more I got involved with people who had a vision for America that was really counter to the dominant paradigm. Then, of course, being in Chicago and getting gassed, we came to Chicago literally with peaceful intent in 68. All we wanted really were permits to sleep in the park. And those permits were denied, and they were denied, and they were denied. And the person who was responsible for it in the mayor's office was a guy named David Stahl. And that's, everybody said, that's all he's ever going to do is stall, stall, stall.
Jay just had given you the permits.
If they had given us the permits, then my guess is everything would have been peaceful. But it was not just the permits were like the overt cause. The covert cause was that the FBI had wired up Mayor Daley and the National Guard to expect trouble. So if I was going to, in the true sense of troublemaker, it was the cops and the National Guard who were the troublemakers, not us, because we did come with peaceful intent.
How did they, WI, wire up the people to expect trouble?
Well, they circulated rumors that we were going to put LSD in the drinking water. Now, I don't know if you've ever tried to do anything like that, but I once tried to dye the reflecting pool in Washington red by pouring dye into it. It's impossible. You have to get so many huge tons of material to make any difference. But they had told the Chicago cops and Mayor Daley that we were going to put LSD in the drinking water. We were going to, pillage, rape, and kidnap. I don't know specifically, but I do know that they produced an atmosphere of fear, and the only response that Daley and the National Guard knew was repression, and the cops knew was repression. It's interesting. There was recently a get together of the Chicago cops who were participated in those demonstrations, who beat people up, and they had a picnic and a barbecue because they felt that they've been maligned all these years for having a police riot, and they felt it was important for them to get together and show their solidarity. And so that was I when I heard about this, I wanted to send them a pig, pig assist, because that's who we ran for president, but I did not get that together. But it was almost a police state in Chicago. And of course, Chicago has a history of suppressing dissent anyway. The Chicago police have that history. I don't know that we, the Yippies, were that aware of exactly what we were walking into. I do know that a lot of people around the country told people, don't come to Chicago, you're going to get massacred. Don't come to Chicago, you're going to get hurt. And, even though they were right in some objective sense, I really disagree, and I disagreed then, and I disagree now with them saying that, because I think that there were only 5,000 people in Chicago. If there had been more, I think that the repression would have necessarily had to be less. So I don't believe in kowtowing to fear tactics, even though, as I say, the cops were definitely wired up to believe that we were going to do bad things.
N-O. Now. They. P. R. P. E. Penn. The demonstrators.
Right. This is the days before penning. This was the days of just pushing in with the phalanxes of cops. You know, the day before anything happened, we were in the park, and this was when we were going to have our so-called Festival of Life, except only one band, the MC5, showed up. Everybody else got scared, basically. And somebody came up behind Stu and hit him over the head with a blackjack, and he started bleeding and fell down, and Abby was freaking out, and I was freaking out. And that was just, you know, so that was a totally provocative act. We were in, you know, nothing was going on, and yet... They were ready. They were ready to provoke. They were ready to pounce. You know.
The, but. You. M. A. Made. L. O. Love. That. Night.
Well, it was hard. There was too much tear gas. Oh, you mean when we got home? Yes, exactly. But that was after, you know, we got to get gas. It was the gassing that sort of was helpful, I think, to the lovemaking. I don't know. But the gas was actually, the gas, you know, running from the, I remember, this is one of those, I'll never forget this kind of moment, because we were walking in the park. It was at night, and it was curfew, and the cops were telling us curfew. And then all of a sudden, I looked behind, and you could see clouds of gas, and there were these lights and soldiers marching, clouds of gas and bright lights coming through the gas, and Stu and I were running ahead of the gas, and it was an extraordinarily scary but also empowering experience, because you said, all right, well, you know, they're there, I'm here, I can do this, I can get through this. And yes, after we got through all the tear gas, which happened every night, we'd go home and make love. I mean, what else was there? Oh no, first we'd watch ourselves on TV. We were yippies. We were yippies, so we'd have to watch it on TV and then we'd make love.
F O F I R first things first.
Exactly. Exactly. But then, you know, by the end of those few days, they were not only gassing people at night, they were doing good in the day. And the last day, and I think it was the 28th in Grant Park, they just came in and right in the middle of the day, right in the middle of a rally, and they came in and they started to beat people and they gassed people, and they blocked off the park. The park that we were in, Grant Park, has bridges that go across to the, you know, the rest of the city, and they blocked off four or five of the bridges, and they made us march, and it was really horrific. And that was when that sort of continued on that day. That was outside. Then ended up outside the Hilton at night, and I was there and walking up the down lines with the folk singer Phil Oakes, and one guy said to him, I once paid $20 for tickets for your concert. I'll never do that again. And Phil actually stopped, and he talked to the guy, and the guy got mellowed, the National Guard, because he was young. He was a young kid, right? But all through it, the attitude of the police was that we were dangerous elements that were somehow out to destroy the city, and they were going to inflict the worst beating they possibly, and gassing that they possibly could on us. But we resisted. It was great.
It. B. A. C. C. It was. No, it B. A. C. K. Backfired.
Yes, exactly. Just as it has since then. If you think about all the other demonstrations, right, including Iran now. Including what happened at the Republican convention this last convention, all of them ultimately, even with their new penning tactics and their this tactics and that tactics, ultimately I believe, I don't have any sort of proof of this, but I believe it backfires, because anyone who's involved and people who are watching, who are sympathetic, become more enraged and more, even though you get scared, you also get more committed to what it is that you're fighting for, I believe. And it's a contradiction. It's a contradiction.
N, no, B, E, because you, S, E, C, that, you see that they don't have that much. C O N T control.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah, that's right. And you know, even though people always die. I mean, like the young woman who was killed recently in Iran. There was a Native American kid who was killed right by the cops the 2 days before the Chicago demonstrations happened in 68. People die when this kind of police brutality happens. And that, to me, is the real tragedy. It's not, you know, getting gassed or getting beaten, because you recover from that, but you don't recover from death. And that's, to me, the, you know, people ought to understand that. That's all.
G, T, A, talk about the R, E, L, A, relationship between A, Abby Hoffman, and Jay.
Jerry Rubin. Okay. Okay. All right. Well, that's an interesting question. I have thought about that, especially because I'm writing. And I think that essentially it was a dysfunctional family. And you have two brothers, which is in a way what their relationship was, two highly competitive, highly intelligent brothers who are locked in this epic battle with each other. And it's interesting because I want to tell you the story about the Pegasi. But I've also thought that, you know, later on, Jerry and Abby toured the country and did what
we
they called the yippee yuppie. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
So why would they do that? Right. What? It wasn't the money, because it wasn't, you know, I mean, it was something, but it wasn't really the money. It was because.
Like W R E wrestlers?
Exactly. Like professional wrestlers. That's exactly right. They loved each other and they hated each other. But you know, I was reading something the other day where Abby was saying basically that you know, he there were times when he couldn't stand Jerry and then he said he'd speak at my funeral and I would speak at his, and that's in fact is what happened. So they were highly competitive with each other, but they also had this bond. I think Jerry always felt that Abby was sort of a bigger star than him and was getting all the PR. And Abby, I think, maybe Abby, if my family analogy is right, then Abby was the older brother, and he kind of ignored Jerry. Jerry was more like a fly buzzing around, but yet at the same time, they were together enough, and they did things together that, and they really appreciated each other too. At the same time, but it was like you never knew what was going to happen, whether they were going to be fighting with each other or working on a project together and really sparking each other, and you never knew. Like the Pegasus story, right? Okay, so they decide to run a pig for president as a symbol. Perfect thing to do. But Abby wants a small, tiny pig, and Jerry wants a great, big, fat pig. And they had this long ideological discussion where Jerry actually wrote out a pamphlet and passed it out about why it needed to be, I mean, this is the yippie ideology, why it needed to be a big pig as opposed to a little, tiny pig. And so actually, Jerry and I and Stu and Phil and some other people went out to a farm and bought this big pig excuse me, which they then we brought into town and got the pig got arrested as soon as he was brought into town. Well, the next day at Grant Park, the Abby's Pegasus shows up. So Keith Lampy's got Keith Lampy brings another pig, and there's Abby's Pegasus. So, so ultimately, they both got their pigs, and they both the pigs got arrested. And of course, the rumors are was that the Chicago cops barbecued and ate the pigs. You know, because we never saw them again. But when they were in jail, when Jerry and Stu were in jail, a cop came up to them and said, "I hate to tell you this, boys, but the pigs squealed." So you know, it was. I would say it was a Jerry and Abby's relationship was complex, but it was also I don't know. It was just very complex. You never knew.
Even no life. In, like, 2MA Mafia? Is it Mafia?
With competing turf? I don't think quite that, because they kind of had the same turf. You know, so Abby would write a book. So then Jerry would write a book. And Jerry's book would be a bestseller. So then Abby would write another book, and Abby's book would be a bestseller. Jerry would speak, and Abby would speak. They were competing for the same turf, I would say. I haven't quite written. I've been starting to write about that part. I haven't quite written it fully, because it's hard for me to think, you know, to think it through. Like I say, it was a very complex relationship that evolved.
C R E A T creative F E E D B feedback. Loop.
Yes, for sure. When they weren't being competitive with each other, when they could hear each other. And then, of course, you know, they did go, of course, on their separate paths after the 60s was over. And but Abby, you know, there's this whole issue with them. Did they give up their core values, right? And the answer is neither of them did. Neither of them did at the core. They, I think, both made some tragic mistakes. Jerry, but even Jerry, you know, he never really worked on Wall Street. He was a publicist, and you could say, all right, that's a problem, and that might be a mistake for sure. But I know he came and visited us once during the just after the Wall Street period, and he said, and when he was by then he was in LA doing. Whatever it was he was doing the vitamins, he was selling vitamins. And he was also talking about how he was working with gang members to try to help them become more entrepreneurial, because that was Jerry always had that entrepreneurial spirit. And you have to ask yourself, is entrepreneurial so bad? Capitalism, yes. Entrepreneurial, a little more complex. Abby, you know, the whole thing about, you know, the drug bust and going underground, that was I would call it a tragic mistake. But the reason it was most tragic was not because of the being set up for, because he was set up for a drug bust, but the fact that it exacerbated his manic depressiveness, which he had. And as you get older, if you're manic depressive, it tends to get worse anyway. And certainly going underground made it significantly worse, so that by the time he surfaced, he was really in pretty bad shape. And so, you know, Abby never gave up. But at the end when he was working on the river and the Save the River, and then when he was working a little bit of stuff with Amy Carter, sort of pre-environmental. I mean, he never gave up on his core values. And I'll tell you something. If Abby was alive today, he would be all over the internet. He was a technological freak way before anyone else was. He was part of this group called the Phone Freaks when they were trying to get, they managed to get free telephone calls in the way before calling cards and way before Skype. Abby was was always attracted to technology. Was in some ways, I think, a technological genius. And you know, he killed himself too soon. You know, he shouldn't have killed himself. But that was the manic depressive disease. And when people have a disease, you have to deal with it as a disease. And truthfully, we didn't know enough then. about it, about that, what was going on with him, and that that's what he had to do, any kind of intervention. And we just didn't know. It was before people knew a lot about that. So it was sad, Abby. And Jerry, too, for that matter.
In his book, you use a lot in Abby's book, in what you do.
Mm-hmm. In which book?
Steal this book?
Steal this book? Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Well, but look, there's Free Cycle today, right? Mm. I mean, Free Cycle is a lot of Steal This Book is now institutionalized in Free Cycle. You know, it's, and I mean, you know, parts of it aren't, but parts of it really are. I think that it's sort of permeated, that way of thinking has permeated the culture. And look at everyone who calls themselves, you know, there was Woodstock Nation, but then all the other nations now that are people consider themselves to be part of this nation or that nation. Even the right wingers use the term. So it's amazing, I think, the way we, the Yippies, influence the cultural dialogue and the cultural forms of expression. Mm. And nobody knows it anymore. Like, one of the things I love, you're either part of the solution, part of the problem, Eldridge Cleaver. How many times have you seen that on car ads? Mm. You know, I mean, Eldridge must be turning over in his grave to see that one.
S-T-U. Stu was the one who was who C-O-N-N-E connected L-E-A-R
Leary. Mm-hmm. Well, that was also, everything is very complex, right? But let me just say first, before we get to Leary, that Stu also played a role in the Abby Jerry. When you asked about the Abby Jerry relationship, he was a mediator between Abby and Jerry. And when things would get really bad, Stu would try to find a way to get Jerry to understand what Abby was doing or saying, or to go and talk to Abby. And he, there were many times when he brought the two of them back together. Now, here's the Leary story is that, see if I can remember it, is that Eldridge was in Algeria, and Leary was in jail, and somehow, and I really have no idea how that happened, but the weatherman concocted a plan to break Leary out of jail, but Leary needed a place to go, so Stu was sent to Algeria to talk to Eldridge, and Eldridge said, sure, yes, bring him here. And so Leary, you know, I think he went to Canada in disguise, and he ended up in Algeria, and Stu essentially was there at that time and helped pave the way. The only problem was that Eldridge had told the Algerian government that Leary was a famous black psychiatrist. So that was, you know, a little bit of a problem. They didn't tell him that he was the LSD king.
Whoa.
Whoa. And then truthfully, Eldridge
he,
and Leary.
He is the O-P opposite of black.
Exactly. Totally. And also, you know, Eldridge and Leary both had enormous egos. And after a very short period of time, they began to not get along because Leary wanted to do one thing. Leary had a need to go out and make himself known to the people who were serving him in a restaurant, and because of that's just who he was. And Stu writes about that in his book, Who the Hell is Stu Albert? He writes a fair bit about that that incident. And Eldridge, you know, was very, also very large ego. And being in Algeria was, while not being in prison, it was still very confining, because mm-hmm. both the cultural norms and the mores, and just there was not that much for Eldridge to do. And so the combination, the Eldridge-Leary combination mm-hmm. just got really toxic mm-hmm. pretty quickly. And Stu was there, I think, for 2 or 3 weeks. And, you know, Leary would go to the beach and take LSD. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of not really something you did in Algeria, even in, you know, the early 1970s. Mm-hmm. And so it was, it got problematic. Mm-hmm. Wow. And then Leary went from there to, I don't remember where he went next. But, he ended up, the part of his deal about coming back mm-hmm. to the United States was to inform on the FBI, but so did Eldridge. Mm-hmm. They both ended up talking to the FBI about their pals, including me and Stu, that was a problem.
Yes. Why? How? No, why? Would? They. F. A. Fall. For. That.
Self-interest. They needed, they wanted to come back. They needed to make a deal. In both cases, they needed to make a deal that would allow them to come back and be at liberty. So that was the deal.
But it would you and undermine their C their C R E
their credibility. You mean did doing that undermine their credibility?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's so interesting because in the long view of history, I think that what both Eldridge and Leary did was very positive. Had they both of them had very positive impacts on the social movements and social thought and moving the revolution forward. I think there's no question about that. Now, I'll tell you the story about what happened with me and Stu as a result of Eldridge's informing, and you tell me whether this undermines their credibility, okay? All right, so the first thing that happens is that and I know this, by the way, because we had a former FBI agent named Wes Swearingen look at our files, and he was able to read the FBI files really well, and he could see who was blacked out. So while we never knew, it was never said, Cleaver said this and this, Wes was absolutely sure that given the spacing and the lettering and so forth, that Eldridge was the one who informed us. All right, so what happens? We get a homing device put on our car, which I discover, and we have a lawsuit that Bill Kunstler was one of the main lawyers in, and so through that we discover that the FBI had burglarized our house 17 times and installed listening devices. So then, as a result of that, we got some money from the lawsuit, and then time passed, and it wasn't, you know, so they did this. We got some money. It was, you know, it was very heavy duty at the time, but after a while, you know, BFD, right? No big deal. So then then Jerry gets hit by a car. In Los Angeles, and Eldridge is living in Los Angeles at the time, and he goes into the hospital and he says, I want to see my brother. And the nurses look at him, you know, Jerry Rubin, and they're saying, what? And Eldridge says, different mothers. So, and he gets in to see him. And then actually the last time we saw Eldridge is when he is at Jerry's grave, and he and Stu and I, and we're all putting earth on the coffin, you know. And then Eldridge, and after that, and now Eldridge is gone too. And so In the long view of history, did it destroy what elders did? No. In the long view of history, I don't think so, but in the long view of history, do we also need to remember that Eldridge was an advocate of rape at a certain point in his life. He was a wife beater. So, like, you know, the longer the view, the more complex it gets. That's just sort of what I've come to understand. It gets very complex, but there is something that binds us all together, you know, those of us who are alive and those of us who are gone. It binds us, our participation in that movement, our real, I think, success in ending a war and in effecting real change in this country, that binds us together. We're all human. People are, and it's interesting because I haven't actually thought this through, so I'm enjoying sort of figuring it out as I'm talking here, but I don't hold them now. I held grudges back then, but you know, if a homing device, house breaking all in, by the FBI, all caused by Eldridge Cleaver, of course I held a grudge back then. It's gone. Maybe because everyone's dead, I don't know, but it's gone. You know, it's like I'm glad the whole process had an opportunity to play itself out. So I don't know. I don't know. I don't think people should only talk about the 60s were wonderful and everything was groovy and everybody was great. I certainly don't agree, however, with the right-wing pundits who do nothing but attack the 60s and the culture wars. I actually this morning went to see the movie about Bill Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe, and his daughters really tackled that question. Maybe that's why it's on my mind. His daughters really tackled that question very well, because Bill defended people who were really, you know, and they started out by saying this in the movie, they were really obnoxious people who you wouldn't think were they were worthy of a defense, but you know, it was just really hard for these teenagers and kids to have to go to school and have their and have demonstrations out there outside their house saying, why is your father defending this person, why is your father defending that person. Like, for example, Bill defended the group of young black men who were accused of raping the Central Park jogger. And what Sarah and Emily, his daughters, have done in the movie is they make a case of, you know, how could he have done that? They start out, but how could he have defended these people? Well, it turns out, and this is right at the end of the movie, and people see it, you know, I am going to give it away. But they point out that it turned out that all these young men were innocent. And they were not the people that attacked the Central Park jogger at all. So there's a redemptive quality in that, you know, and I think that despite their flaws, their human flaws, Eldridge, Leary, you know, Jerry, Abby, despite their human flaws, there was a redemptive quality in everything that they did, unlike people, say, for example, like David Horowitz, who was a lefty and became a righty. That I do not forgive.
I M E met Leary, and I was and I D I S C discovered the M A E D I A media even B E before no even I discovered the media even B E B R A I brain wash me. I was expecting a C R crazy crazy person and he was not crazy.
Leary? Oh, no. Leary was brilliant. Oh, brilliant man.
But the media, that insidious way of, like, before you even realize it yourself, you have this impression of somebody.
Right, right.
Even though you
right.
think you're, like, so smart.
Right.
You know? He, P, played with A, I, R, P, airplane. He played airplane with Frank. Was at a conference about psychedelics or something
yeah.
here at the Claremont
yeah.
Hotel.
Yeah.
And a bunch of us went. And
yeah.
We walked in and Leary came running up to Frank.
Oh, cool.
Like he was like an old buddy and hugged
yeah.
him and said hi and all that. I was like,
cool.
wow. But and then we kind of saw him throughout the course of the evening. And
right.
at one time he was sitting on this bench talking to these young guys and they were kind of like this, like hanging
right.
on his every word.
Right.
And when Frank went by, you know, Frank's like spazzing as he goes by,
right.
and Leary started playing with him.
Oh, cool.
And kind of knowing that, you know, and these kids are like trying to figure out, like, okay, like,
what's going on?
This?
Right, right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Leary was very authentic in his cosmic consciousness. He was totally authentic, and he, so that does not surprise, that story does not surprise me, not a bit,
yeah.
actually. You know, when Anita was dying, Rosemary came and helped take care of her. And actually, Rosemary brought a bunch of her friends who were marijuana cultivators. Mm-hmm. And what I learned there, which I didn't know, is that after these women were actually cultivating, well, here's marijuana that will be helpful if you have breast cancer. Here's marijuana that will, it's a little bit of a different type that will be helpful if you have this kind of cancer. Not in a curative sense, but just in a pain relief sense. And they had actually grown many different types of dope. Just specifically targeted to illnesses, and I thought to myself, you know, that is a good legacy that Leary has given all of us. So it wasn't just LSD; it was the importance of what we used to call good drugs as opposed to bad drugs, but the psychedelic the experiences.
Yes. Would you? T, talk about W, I, T, which?
Oh, which? You mean the Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell?
Yes.
You know, when I think about it, what's interesting is that if we used that word today, we would be like, oh my God, who are you? But this is the day before terrorists were terrorists, you know what I mean, the capital T. It was a women's group. It was a group of women who, and mostly in New York, and we would basically dress up in costume and go out and put hexes on things, which is why I like the Pentagon. It kind of started, they didn't start as a group in the Pentagon, but it was an offshoot of the levitation of the Pentagon, and we just, you know, that's what we did. I don't remember any specific actions, except it was a lot of fun.
P. R. P. People. Don't. T. Don't. R. E. A. L. Realize. Have. Fun. Having fun. Is. Very. P, powerful.
Exactly. And that, if I have any issues or problems with the movement today, it's the seriousness of it. Because I think that you have to have fun in order to actually attract people, in order to have a good time and a good experience yourself. You have to have fun. And I know that people get so caught up in the seriousness of the issues that it's just really difficult to have a good time. And that's what was so great about the Yippies, is that that's what we did, is we liked to have fun.
H, U, humor, using humor.
Exactly, using humor to send things up, to point out contradictions. Yes, exactly, using humor.
And they don't know how to handle that.
Exactly. I mean, you know, I try to, like, here's an example. We're having a yard sale next weekend. If anybody's watching, we're having a yard sale that next weekend. Look for estate sale on Craigslist. And I thought about saying, because I didn't want to put the address up right away, because first of all, because people would come and there wouldn't be anybody there to sell stuff, so I didn't want to do that. So I thought about putting in my ad that the sale is at an undisclosed location, right? I thought that would be funny, and then I said, you know, I can't, people take it all so seriously, I can't do that. Even just a little joke, you know, here we are in 2009, right? I didn't feel free enough to make a little joke in my Craigslist ad about the yard sale, just because, you know, it's not that there aren't serious issues, right? It's not that there aren't serious things going on in the world. It's not that the world isn't going to hell in a handbasket, or that and people are losing jobs and getting fired, and all that is happening. But it's very easy to get depressed and feel like a victim. And it's a lot harder to look for the fun in it and to try to. But I think that if you can even find one thing to be humorous about, it's that laughter is healing. You know, we had the issues in 1968. We felt they were as serious as the issues today. I don't think, you know, in terms of economics and people's lives being affected. Maybe they were, maybe they weren't. I don't know. But we always found a way to laugh at what we were doing, to put forward that laughter is, if you can hold people up to and have them look in the mirror, you know, look in the mirror and see themselves truly and laugh at that, then that'll move things much longer than long, boring discussions about ideology and more ideology.
W, like, I just want E, no, W, R, wrote a letter. Is this about the BTV thing? And what about that? I and it and my TA tagline was I was S I am shocked that they are stonewalling you too. because he's talking to, this is the local public access channel, and uh-huh. the show will play on a show Frank's had on there for almost 10 years.
Oh,
it's
great.
A weekly show. And we've battled with them before a number of years ago about adult programming,
right.
And won.
Right.
And so now we're starting again another battle because they've changed all the rules.
Uh-huh.
And they basically took the public access out of public access.
Oh, interesting.
So now you have to be a member to have a series.
Uh-huh.
And you have to pay to be a member.
Of course.
And you can't just go and drop off a tape or a DVD and they play. You have to pay $5 each time you drop something off if it's not a series. You can't sponsor somebody else's show without being a member. Even if you are a member, you don't get first dibs at time slots unless you make your show on the premises.
Huh.
So for us, because we make it here, we never will get first shot.
Right.
You know, even though we've had the time slot for many years. And then rules like one person can't host a show twice in one day. Like, you know, what does that mean?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And it just goes on and on and on. And Frank, the person we've been dealing with is the program director because she's the one that we speak to all the time.
Right.
She, T, R, E, refused to which thing? About the sponsors? Is that it? Yeah, we noticed that there were a lot of shows that seemed to be taken off of this website. That's like a national site, PEGS Media, I think it's called. And so they're not local shows. And she knocked, you know, several of our shows off the air with the new rules, or they did. And Frank has always said, if there's local stuff to put on, he's happy to just go down to one show.
Right.
And
right,
she
right.
said, don't worry, we'll fill the space when we got knocked off. So we were wondering how they filled it. Well, all of a sudden, we found 14 shows that came right off of this website. So we said, could you tell us who the local sponsors of those shows are? Well, she, that is a privacy issue. I will never disclose to anybody who a sponsor is. Well, meanwhile, you know, like before the new rules, that was like something they announced all the time. We would anybody who asks will give you the name of who sponsors the show, who produces the show. And we know they do because they gave our name out plenty of times to people. And so in the process of Frank working this out with her, he ended up talking to the executive director, or she, as she said, she don't M-K know if they're allowed to if there are was a rule about not giving out or giving out. Because we pointed out to her that there actually is, you know, that the disclosing of that is something that is part of their deal, that they're supposed to do that. And she said, I don't know anything about that. So we went to the executive director, and he said, tell me what show you want to know. I'll tell you. So Frank wrote back to her, and he said, well, do you now know that there's a rule? And she wouldn't answer him. She kept saying, noted and forwarded, noted and forwarded. Well, everything he wrote to her, noted and forwarded. So, and they, but Frank, like, meticulous, will go through line by line by line,
figure it out,
every issue. To the point where he broke her down, and now she's talking to him.
Oh, well, that's good.
And so his tagline on one of them was, I'm shocked that they're stonewalling you two. Like, we're both on the same side.
That's really funny.
Yeah, but course we didn't hear back from her after that.
And so now who was the overall what this was public access television?
Yes, it's Berkeley's public access channel.
But so who is in charge?
They have a non the city
has a board,
has a non-profit that they empower to run the public access channel, and the board of the non-profit has made all these new rules.
I see.
And
well, you know, if you look them up on GuideStar, you know about GuideStar? GuideStar is a wonderful resource for actually for anyone, because it lists the 990 forms for all nonprofits, and so you can find out the names of the boards, where the money's coming in, where the money's going out. It's definitely worth, and it's free. GuideStar. I think it's a .org.
You getting it, Mikey?
And so it would be probably worth it would be worth looking these people up. Just you get more information about them.
Yes.
Now, well, I have a question. Is there any chance I could get a little coffee?
Oh, of course.
Because I am.
Hey, Corey and Alexi, could you bring down a coffee? How would you like it? With cream or without
cream?
With
cream.
Half and half, I think.
That'd be
that
perfect.
Okay?
That'd
do you
be
like
perfect.
Sugar or
no
anything?
No sugar, just a little half and half.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mikey, you're confirming they got that? Okay. The B O A, the board of directors. R, no, don't, no, R, E, F, refused. They Frank invited them to be on a show that he was arranging.
Yeah, well,
to
of course they're going
to
refuse.
But they cited the Brown Act. They said they couldn't come on because the Brown Act wouldn't allow them to come on. So Frank, of course, quotes the Brown Act to them, says it's a Sunshine Act, and explains why it doesn't apply.
Right, right.
And they're still, They're still thinking about that.
Yeah.
One.
Well, I mean, they've got a stonewall.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
They've got to, because you don't know what their overall strategic plan is, because I'm sure it's not just you guys. I'm sure it has to do with content or something. I mean, there's been some kind of shift in thinking that has produced this, and you're just feeling the effects of it. But what would interest me was what's going on in the board's mind. What are the board discussions?
They think it is. They think it is their channel, not Berkeley's residents.
Well, but the Berkeley City Government is one of the most arrogant institutions I've ever come across. I mean, they really are. It's just amazing. And so it doesn't surprise me that they have this own little fiefdom. I mean, I don't know them from Adam, right? But it doesn't surprise me, given what I do know about the Berkeley City Government, that they have this little fiefdom that they figure is theirs to control, not the people's.
We S P R E spent a year with the last battle. We spent a year fighting it.
And
we had a lot of meetings. F U fun. We had fun.
Oh, good. Well, see, that's the important point. If you can have fun, do as we were saying, right?
We always laugh and say, if they only knew how much fun we have with this kind of thing, they think this is like a hardship. And
right.
It gets Frank up in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there you go. Well, it's good. I mean, if this is a battle you choose to fight, that's a whole other way of doing things.
Yeah.
It's when they do, when you don't choose to fight it. And it just comes on you in the form of an edict, then that is where it gets problematic.
J. H. Helms. We had that. Frank was investigated by Jesse Helms in the early 90s as an obscene artist.
Well, that's a badge of honor.
Yeah, that's what. And that was a case where, it were like a handful of artists that he had the General Accounting Office investigating.
Wow.
And the rest of them, got burned out by it. They saw it as keeping them from their art and stuff like that. Whereas Frank was like, okay, this is what I'm doing now.
Right.
And
right.
had a good time with it. And you don't do the K-I kind of W O R work. I do a if you are not willing to take these things and go with them and have fun.
Right.
It would be dumb to do the kind of work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you'd burn out.
Yeah.
You'd burn out. So no, it's good if you've got to be able to have fun. You've got to. And it's good that you can take that on.
That is one of the things I learned from the yippies.
Exactly. You have to, if you can't have fun, it's not, while you're doing it, it's not worth doing. That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
B-I-O violence is not a G R E a great T tool for change, but H. Humor
is. Yeah. But let me ask you this. What do you mean by violence?
My P H physical violence.
No, it's not a great tool. But I mean, because I've been thinking a lot about this, and it's an interesting question. Where do you draw the line? In other words, you take, the whole Sarah Palin palling around with terrorists, Billy Ayers blowing up, and the weatherman blowing up a bathroom in the Capitol building. Was that violence?
Not P E R S O personal.
Not persons, right? So property destruction somehow is not, but it goes to.
But it is a W Q U E S a question A about no A B questionable T O tool in T, E, in terms of W, O, R, working.
Yes, I do not disagree with that. And you know, if you take the context in which, say, the Capitol stuff took place, by then almost 50,000 people had been killed in Vietnam. Americans had been killed. God knows how many Vietnamese women, children had been massacred, napalmed, villages destroyed and blown up. And so there was a context in an increasingly. I know that we in the movement were getting increasingly frustrated as all the the humor and the fun and seemed to be kind of ebbing away as the war ground on and on and on and on.
Yes.
So I'm not to say that any of us in the Yippies did that type of thing, because we didn't, but you had to look at it and say, all right, is this say property destruction? Is this, and if nothing else is working, then what can you do? What are the options? And I totally agree with you that anything that involves people getting hurt, but then is a problem. But then all the people get hurt, by the police or the National Guard or the soldiers or whoever. In other words, people like say soldiers in Vietnam. And again, I talk about this because this is what I know better than. But I know that it's also a same syndrome. The soldiers who are there, not only are they can they get physically wounded and killed, but the mental wounds happen as well. So, and that's a form of violence. In countries like Rwanda, where rape is a instrument of war. That's all. These are forms of violence. And so the question is, how do you resist that? Is it Gandhian nonviolence? I mean, it's
there. We always use their V violence. We always use their violence.
I mean, we use it against us?
What do you mean we use their violence to get to make change? Is that what you mean? We use their violence to make change or against them?
I don't understand.
How does that work? The like G, H, A, Gandhi, G, O, got them to be violent. Gandhi got them to be violent. He did or he did not get, he did not, you, what do you, no, he did not be violent. He was not violent? No, he, is that what you mean? He was not violent, but he got them to be violent.
You mean he provoked
he
them?
He provoked them.
Uh-huh.
At, to, M, A, make it obvious, to make it obvious what uh-huh. they were about uh-huh. for those uh-huh. who didn't get it.
Right.
Like, K, I, N, King, C, King was, Martin Luther King
mm-hmm.
was not violent.
Right.
But he, it's your coffee, but he, thanks Corey.
Great, thank you very much.
But he, G, O, he got them to be violent.
Right. Well, it's what Dave Dellinger used to do as well, passive nonviolent civil disobedience is what it was called. But what if you take a situation like, in, again, my reference is back in 1968, in the Black Panthers. Mm. Who talked about defending themselves against armed attack, or in countries where people are being attacked? That's it's hard. It's hard to know what the response should be. Now, certainly, like the word World Trade Center, right? None of us, I think, believe that the appropriate response to that was to go and invade, especially a country that had nothing to do with it. But how do you respond to something like that, that is appropriate? What is an appropriate response to that type of violence, even though you could make a great case as to how America has set itself up in the world, that somehow America provoked this attack on itself? I don't know, but what is the appropriate response to something like that?
Like,
and I don't have an answer.
Like the H, like the G, O, government, we then, like the government then, S, E, set up the P, A, N, T, H, Panthers.
Right. Kill Fred Hampton, right?
To pardon me?
Just in killing Fred Hampton and killing other Panthers.
To be violent. They set the Panthers up to be violent.
I don't think so. I respectfully disagree. And the reason I don't think so is that so you're saying that the original police attacks on the Panthers, that where people were, where Panthers were killed, was in fact a setup by the government to get them to be violent? That's certainly not the way I remember it. I remember it as people saying, you know, we are an oppressed colony within the United States, and we have the right to defend ourselves against police attack.
In they. S, T, R, E, S stressed. No, they S E N sent. B O G. No, B O G. Bogus. L.
Letters. Oh yeah, letters. I know. I remember them. I've seen them. Kathleen showed them to me. No, I know. I know that. See, what they did is they exacerbated. They exacerbated what was going on. But if you go back to the very beginning, to I'm not sure. I think that there was a whole atmosphere of intimidation by the what Bobby would call a white racist power structure, by the white racist police. That wasn't a setup. That was just the way people knew to act. That's the way the police were taught to act. That's the way. And so finally, after years of oppression, the Panthers of the black community, the Panthers stood up and said, "We have the right to defend ourselves." And basically, they used the sort of the Second Amendment that the right wing, the NRA, is using in some sense in a very similar way, saying, yes. You know, we have the right to defend ourselves now, just because we want to carry guns not only in our own home but across state lines into state parks. I mean, you know, it's like the Panthers didn't do that, but it's like there's a confusion between oppressed people who really were the recipients of violent attacks by people in power, and I don't think that was a setup. I think that was a historic fact. And to me, what was the most compelling thing about the Panthers was they're saying, "All right, we're not going to take it anymore. And we're going to defend ourselves." Now, did people get killed in that? Yes. Were the Panthers always right in what they did? No, absolutely not. They were people killed who did not, who innocent by everything. You know, it did get pretty bad pretty quickly. But the fundamental principle that you have, you should not be the victim of racist attack. And if nonviolence doesn't work, then what do you do? I mean, I'm not saying I have an answer, but it's just these are, I think, important questions.
And how did the WRE Weather Underground get to be a C U L cultural
cult? Yeah, I actually think that they weren't. I mean, I know that I wrote that, but it was really more that they were a cult, like they were getting there, getting toward being a cult. I don't think they were an actual Jim Jones kind of cult. Of course, I wasn't in the Weather Underground, so I don't. This is an observing from afar. I mean, I've heard various explanations, and Mark Rudd has an explanation in his book, which I actually really recommend. It's a book called Underground. Some people blame it on one particular person, one of the people who was blown up in the townhouse. Other people sort of talk about them simply them getting more and more isolated. But you have to remember that no matter how cult-like they got for a certain moment in time, they never overtly killed anyone. They didn't ever go out and say, "All right, we're going to have a strategy where we go out and kill people." That was they never went beyond property damage in their actions. Now, maybe they were talking about it. I don't know. You know, Mark says one thing, somebody else says something else. I don't know. I wasn't there. But I think that you know, you can get so isolated and so crazed at a certain point that you can get. You know, you can go a little off the deep end, and that may have indeed happened to some of them. Not to all of them, but to some of them. But still, there was never a sense of offensive violence. And certainly if you compare, if you use the David and Goliath analogy, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, look at what America has, what the American government has done in the name of pacification, in the name of peace, in the name of expanding empire, whatever you want to call it. So I don't know. You know, like I say, it's the older I get, the more complex things get. Everything was nice and black and white when I was in my 20s and 30s.
What? When? They? Mm-hmm. Have? All? The? H? Mm. All the G? Mm. U? Mm. Guns? Mm-hmm. Or? Mm. M-O? Mm. Or most of the guns? Mm-hmm. Mm. B, violence is A, Q, questionable tactic, questionable strategy or tactic.
Because you're outnumbered.
Yes.
But what about the, what about Vietnam? What about the guerrilla fighters? The French had most of the guns, the Americans had most of the guns, and yet the guerrilla fighters won.
And I R L Ireland
and Ireland, yeah. Well, Ireland, you know, there's still stuff going on in Ireland, so I don't. If you wanna talk about that, you need to talk to Ringo Hallinan. He knows way more about that than I do. But there was There was one other country that I was thinking of. It's just hard. If you look around the world today, right, today, and you say, all right, where are there countries where there is essentially, they don't have that either history or legacy of offensive violence against other countries. It's not England, it's not Britain, it's not the United States. But you say you take a place like Sweden and Norway, and there aren't very many. There's very no guns, there's no murder. I mean, I'm from Canada. Even there, our murder rate and so forth is a lot less, just because there aren't guns, you know, there aren't guns. So I'm not advocating by any means that we have guns available to everyone. But then you have to look at the concrete situation here in America where that is true. And so then what do you do? You know, what do, I don't know. I still don't know. I don't think we've solved it yet.
But. H. I. H. U. M. Humor?
Humor.
Is
back to A humor.
H G R E great, greater, great T tool. But
right.
Humor
exactly.
Is a great tool.
Humor is, there's no, absolutely no question. There is no question. If you can't laugh, what was it Emma Goldman said? If I can't laugh in your revolution, I don't want to be part of it. Something like that.
D, A, dance.
Dance, right. No, dance, laugh, love. You know, yeah. Che, the true revolutionary, is guided by great feelings of love. John Lennon, all you need is love. Dance, laugh, love. It's all part, that's exactly right. It's all the positive aspect, the positive part of things. And if that is not part of your struggle, then you are the Taliban. That's what I think.
Some S O C A so-called T no some so-called R radicals will not come on this show
because
of the art that Frank does.
Yeah, well, they're. Yeah. You know, there are some people who are always going to be repressed, socially and emotionally repressed. And sadly, there's nothing you can do about that. And I believe it's not worth wasting your time with the repressed people, because they're going to live their life as control freaks, and there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, that was one of the wonder. That was one of the really good parts of the '60s, was the sense of discovering one's own sexuality for yourself and doing what you wanted to do with it, not what anyone else wanted you to do with it, but what you wanted. You know, at the same time, there were women who were taken, especially women who were taken advantage of, who were raped, who had, you know, terrible, terrible experiences on the name of, say, free love. But for me at least, and for a number of other people that I know, it was like the, even the concept of free love or sexuality or discovering one's own sexuality was a very liberating thing. And as long as you weren't taken advantage of by anyone else, then it was... you know, like an enormously positive thing. So if, like I say, if repressed people won't come on your show, screw them. That's what I say.
And T R I B tribal L I living. What about that?
Well, that's a tribal living, a communal living, right? Okay, so I have actually had the privilege of being a participant observer in all these things because we certainly, you know, we considered ourselves a tribe back in the day. We lived in communal houses that were very dirty. I mean, physically very dirty. They were not fun to live in in that sense. If you had any sense of hygiene, you got appalled.
Yeah.
I now live in Berkeley co-housing,
which
is not dirty.
D O G dog S dog shit
on the floor. Now, how did you? I didn't publish that. I took that out. How did you find out about that?
I lived in communal housing, so he had the experience.
Oh my God! Well, in the basement. I don't know where it was in yours, but in mine, it was in the basement. There was a basement full of dog shit. It was disgusting.
All over the house.
Ugh, even worse. Well, but I have to tell you, I now live. All right, I now live in a way what is a modern evolution of some sense of that type of communal tribal living, which is co-housing community. Each one of us, we all have our own homes. We all own our own homes. We eat dinner together 3 days a week. We cook for each other four times a quarter. We clean up collectively. But there are written and unwritten norms of behavior about how you treat each other. And it was interesting because I was talking about this, sort of my background, to a group of co-housers, one of whom was a 16-year-old, and he said, well, what was the difference? And what I talked about was how we had no rules then, so no one could say to someone else, clean up the dog shit in the basement on the floor, because there were just no appreciation of that type of, you know, that someone could actually say that to somebody else. In co-housing, in some sense, we've gone to the other extreme, because certainly in the common areas, there's absolutely no, you're allowed to do what you want in your own home, but in the common areas, you know, everything is looked at and scrutinized in terms of what benefits the community as opposed to what benefits the individual. The difficulty is, and it's a both difficulty and a challenge, is that all decisions are made by consensus in co-housing. So that can take an awfully long time to convince people to, but I've also learned how to be patient and learned sort of how to, and I've actually learned a lot through the consensus process, which I used to think, you know, you can never get anything done with consensus. You just want to go ahead and do, you know, the do it, the Jerry Rubin do it, right? So, in our community, we have age range of 2 years to 77 years, or no, 79 years. And as I say, people do look out for each other in a way that that actually I didn't find in the more unevolved
tribal situations of the past. And that was just living. I'm just talking living situations. I'm not, for example, talking like the Berkeley Tribe, a newspaper where we all worked together, called ourselves a tribe, felt like a tribe. Mm-hmm. But we didn't. We did live together, some of us, but at least we all had similar standards of cleanliness from what I recall.
Mm. I. We have two houses.
Uh-huh. Oh, really?
This house and then a few houses down. Uh-huh. There's another house, and there's six of us that live in the two houses.
Wow.
And we live tribally. Even though, like, you know, some of us sleep in one house, some of us sleep in the other house.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's, we all kind of, it's all one thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's, in some ways, it's much better than living in an isolated, you know, a single person, couple, whatever it happens to be. It really is, because there's more interaction, there's more community, a tribe, community, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
I know that we have, it's funny, about once every 2 or 3 months there's a tour through Berkeley co-housing, right? And I feel like an animal in a zoo, because people come in and they look, you got such a wonderful house, this is such a great community. And you know, it's kind of amazing to watch people come through, and they really want, they're looking for, what people are looking for is community. And they're trying to find ways to build it. And I know that there's a lot of, I think it's, if you actually Google, I think it's ebaycoho.org. Or cohousing.org, something like that. You come up with there's a number of websites cohousing is a pretty popular movement here in the United States. I think there's something like 150 cohousing communities where people, you know, ranging from 14, like ours is 14, but there's some that have 40 and 50 units, and it's a good blend of individual living and communal living.
We P-E people are hungry for that.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I see that in the tours, because the tours are really popular. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's right. People are hungry for some kind of communal living. And I've only been living there a year, but I've come to really appreciate what the advantages are. And the disadvantages. You know, nothing is perfect.
Talk about M A Y May Day.
Talk about May Day. Okay. I wonder, I'm just trying to remember if I have any May Day pictures in there. I don't think I do. Well, May Day was a demonstration that took place in 1971 in Washington. And the slogan of the demonstration was, "If the government won't stop the war, we'll stop the government." And I actually wrote an article about my participation in it that was in Counterpunch. So, you know, you can always go to Counterpunch for the details.
You read it? But all of it, all of them, L A S T last N night. You read all.
You read
of
all the entire collective works of Judy Gumbo. Huh?
He did his homework.
Good for you. Well, what would you like me to talk about May Day? About sort of how I got there and what happened and.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Well, I remember how I got there. That was a time in Stu and my relationship when we had broken up, and I had gone down to Washington to work on this demonstration, This is the house, and we were living in a house on M Street. It was 2226 M Street, and this is actually, in fact, the house, and I did not put this in the article because people thought it was a little too gross, but this was the house, in fact, where there was dog shit in the basement. And it was one of those situations where, I mean, you know, maybe what I should do is read it a little bit. Do you want me to do that?
Yes.
All right, because I did bring it.
Oh, that's
I'm
okay.
Sorry.
That's okay, Mikey.
I missed the...
Missed the table.
Right.
Mikey will clean up.
God, and I was enjoying that.
Well, we can get you another one.
That's okay.
Get a refill.
Oh, that's what we need is the paper towel.
All right. Well, maybe we'll keep... you should keep going.
Okay.
Mikey will...
All right. No. I will. Let me get the Mayday piece out. I believe I brought it because it'd be easier for me to read it than it will be to try to reconstruct it, especially at 9:30 at night. Okay. All right. So as I said, Stu and I had broken off our relationship. All right. So All right. I'm staying temporarily in Washington D.C. in a collective house at 2226 M Street. Chicago Conspiracy 8 defendant and anti-war activist Rennie Davis and at least 30 others live in the surrounding neighborhood. The M Street house is situated directly across the street from a red brick fire station that, in addition to fire trucks, is outfitted with surveillance cameras so overtly visible in the front window that I occasionally lead a group of us out front just to dance and wave at them. It's true. I mean, I remember this totally vividly. That just walked out, and there were you could see in the windows. You could see the lens of the camera just pointing at us. So we call ourselves the Mayday Tribe. Our name, Mayday, is intended to convey an urgent distress call about the war, to the Vietnam War, of course, to the American people, and motivate protesters to come to a demonstration scheduled for 3 months later. We're putting together a People's Peace Treaty on behalf of the American public to draw attention to the Nixon administration's obdurate refusal to make peace. Our admittedly utopian demonstration slogan states, "If the government won't stop the war, we'll stop the government." We predict that thousands of people will take to the streets and block traffic to protest the war and this recent escalation in bombing, because it's just after the bombing of Laos and Cambodia. At my initiation, Stu and I have officially broken off our two-year-old romance. As I recall, I feel fine. Liberated, in fact. I have no qualms about publicly labeling Stu an arrogant, patronizing, sexist, male chauvinist pig, which, looking back on it, was about 35% true and 65% women's movement PC rhetoric. Now, when I wrote that line, I actually had to take some time and think, well, what was the truth? How sexist was he, and what was rhetoric? And I went back, maybe it was 30-70, maybe it was 60-40, and then I compromised with myself on 35-65. Besides, Stu and I are still on speaking terms. I realize he's lonely without me and know that I can still get him to do almost anything I want. So I ask him to come and visit from New York and bring with him on the plane a large satchel of high-quality marijuana. Now, actually, I checked later, and actually he did not come on the plane. That's wrong. He actually came on the bus, because I said to myself, how could he really brought marijuana in the plane, and he didn't, so it was on the bus.
I did that. Took marijuana on a bus.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think it was a preferred mode of transportation.
But W I with A F FBI. There was an FBI infiltrator guy that ended up getting a bus ticket and traveling with them.
How did you know he was an infiltrator?
Everyone knew it.
Uh-huh.
He didn't know that.
Thanks
everyone
so
knew
much.
It. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so early in the morning of Monday, March 1st, 1971, the M Street phone rings. Let me just say, I wrote this piece particularly after Sarah Palin started to talk about the weathermen and palling around with this is sort of my response. Okay, so we're told that members of the Weather Underground, originally known as weathermen, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows, are taking credit for placing a bomb in an out-of-the-way men's bathroom of the United States Capitol building. The weathermen say, "We've attacked the Capitol because it is, along with the White House and the Pentagon, the worldwide symbol of the government which is now attacking Indochina." When I first hear this news, I feel exhilarated, irrationally exuberant, in fact. My reaction is documented by an unknown person, possibly an informant, who in a later legal affidavit describes me and the others in M Street as exultant, which is not so far removed from my own recollection. But why, you quite rightly ask, and I ask myself the same question, did I feel so positive about this act? Especially, and this goes back to our previous discussion about violence, especially when placing a bomb is something that I could never do or did myself. At the time, I felt like a cheerleader rooting for David in the face of Goliath. And as an anti-war activist, I considered dissent to be patriotic. I saw the weathermen as courageous enough to take the lead in our very own 60s-style Boston Tea Party. In my view, they blew up the U.S. Capitol bathroom on my behalf and on behalf of the entire anti-war movement. So that's why I say we might disagree with how we got there. I appreciated that they did so for the most compelling of reasons, to stop the endless brutal war in Vietnam and Laos. Their act empowered me, which is why I could, in good conscience, in 1971, make the statement, we didn't do it, but we dug it. Now, that statement, that we didn't do it, but we dug it statement, is something that has... I wouldn't say haunted because that's too negative, but it's been with me all my life. And this is where the picture does come in. When we were, let me see if I can, here we are. When I made that statement, I did it at a press conference with Jerry and Stu. So there's Stu, there's me, and there's Jerry. I don't know if you can get this. And I did it for the reasons that I just read. I made that statement, but because we were then subsequently subpoenaed to a grand jury investigating the Capitol bombing, and as a result, we endured a lot of harassment and thought we were going to jail. But then, of course, since we were in fact innocent, since we were not the bombers, the Weather Underground with the bombers, they actually, eventually the indictments and the subpoenas to the grand jury were dropped. But, you know, of course, what I have to do is ask myself today, right, how do I feel about the we didn't do it but we dug it statement today? And it was true then. I knew I didn't do it, but I knew that I dug it because it was the only way I felt that it was possible to... But at that point, after all that demonstrating, it's the only way I felt that it was possible to do something about the war.
M-O, most of us, F-E, felt like that.
Good. That's good to know, because I didn't know whether most people did or not. So, shall I go on with the story? Okay. Immediately after the bombing, M Street house surveillance intensifies. Firemen swarm. Burly new guys start hanging out around the firehouse. They didn't even look and weren't even dressed like firemen. Stu and Leslie Bacon, a young anti-war activist friend who lives here in Berkeley, by the way, decide to take a walk in Lafayette Park, directly in front of the White House. Beyond the macho of it, I can't speculate about Stu's motives. Most likely, I disapproved because at that particular moment in our on-again, off-again relationship, almost everything he said or did was enough to provoke my disapproval. As the tension-filled day after bombing dragged on, it became increasingly clear to me that there was no time like the present to get the hell out of Dodge. Leslie chose to remain in D.C. I grabbed Stu, Colin, and Michael, two other M Street residents, plus a couple of bags of clothing, and we hopped into my 1969 dark blue VW Beetle named Lindequist. When I bought the car, I found the previous owner's name, Lindequist, inscribed on the dashboard. I currently drive Lindequist 3. Actually, that's not true. My daughter now drives Lindequist 3. A few blocks into our getaway, I realized I'd forgotten my all-time favorite hat, a fisherman's cap made out of fluffy brown Canadian beaver pelts with a brown leather front brim. Stu and I immediately get into a huge fight. Stu, the pragmatist, now recognizes the wisdom of leaving town as quickly as possible. I, the yippie fashionista, will not leave my favorite hat to the mercy of the pigs. It's my car. I'm the driver. We circle back. I run in, save my hat, and like Keystone Cops, we once again beat a hasty retreat. There's no PETA yet to make my hat a political issue. But in the early evening, just as it's getting dark and chilly, and we've reached the outskirts of Baltimore, I suddenly notice flashing lights behind me. I pull Lindquist over and hear a loud, gruff male voice coming over a loudspeaker. "Get out of the car with your hands up." Shotguns at our heads, the four of us are quickly spread-eagled against the VW. Colin is shaking so hard I think he might piss himself, but he doesn't. The boys are put in one police car. I'm alone in another. Colin, by the way, I was able to talk to him after the, you know, email him afterwards. He's a little unhappy that I put this in, but I said, well, you know, it wasn't authentic. So I said, yeah, it's all right. All right. The boys are put in one police car. I'm alone in another for what feels like hours. I'm buzzy with adrenaline and really bored, sitting alone in my personal Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome cage. I can't see much except cops and the boys' heads in front of me and in the other car, so all I can do is bite my nails and obsess. Lindquist and the satchels are thoroughly searched. Eventually, we are released, and in true Yippie absurdist fashion, are given a ticket for a bald tire by a local highway patrolman who signs his name James Bond. We're not weathermen. It literally didn't occur to me that we were being stopped because of the Capitol bombing. I'm really grateful we left the marijuana back in D.C. And so that was, you know, sort of, and then 3 months later, we actually did have the May Day demonstration, which I came to. I led a contingent from Boston, and as I write in the piece, I was, by then I guess we'd had gotten the dope back somehow, because when the time I woke up, May Day started really early in the morning, and by the time I and my contingent woke up, it was too late. And I actually, you know, I remember this. This is sort of a lifelong lesson, right? I remember trying to get up at 6 o'clock, not able to, and just saying, all right, we're going to go back to sleep. And then we basically missed it. You know, there were 7,000 people arrested, and we missed it. It was a failure of leadership on my part. And the lesson is never smoke dope the night before a big demonstration. So May Day was actually, I mean, you know, for everyone who got there, who actually got downtown in time to get arrested, it was actually a very good event. We did not stop the war. We did not stop the government. We did stop traffic for a little bit. But it had a very strong impact, I think, on those who participated. By then, the media wasn't covering it as much as they were covering, say, Chicago in 68, because they learned not to do that. But it was actually, I think, a very important, I mean, the people who were there remember it as an important event.
F. You. Funny. At that time, I was L. I living in D.C. By that time, I was living in D.C. at a head shop.
Where? What? Where was it located?
C.O.N.N. E.
Connecticut Avenue?
Yes.
Now, did you remember the Quicksilver Times?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. That was a very good, I liked that paper a lot. I mean, that was a definitely on the countercultural end of the underground newspapers.
I. Always. W. R. Wrote. For underground newspapers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then today you're on the internet. And it's like it's the logical transition, and we don't kill trees.
Yeah. How did S-T-U.
He's actually S-T-E-W, but that's okay.
Stuart. And get in two. J. No. H. I. H. I. No. H. I. V. How did he get into HIV?
HIV? He didn't, you mean HIV AIDS? He did not have, he had hepatitis C. He died of liver cancer as a result. Is that what you're talking about?
I. M. I mean. L. No, I mean he was a activist.
Mm-hmm.
An AIDS, was he an AIDS activist?
Uh-uh.
No. Wrong information.
I do want to say, by the way, that you know, that we, even though in this particular story in 1971 mm-hmm. we were separated, we got back together in after the we both were in Miami in 1972 mm-hmm. for both the Democratic and the Republican convention. Mm-hmm. He was with the Yippies. I was with, I think that's a group called mm-hmm. the Miami Women's Coalition. But as a result of that, he then had a medical problem, and I went to visit him, and he was in the hospital, mm-hmm. and you'll like this story. So he was in the hospital. I think he had some kind of heart murmur at that moment. Mm-hmm. And but we had broken up. And so three of his friends, and he was all hooked up to various machines, and the doctors mm-hmm. were monitoring him. This was in New York. He left Miami to go to New York. And so three of his friends came to visit him, and he called them the Angels of Mercy, and they brought some cocaine with them. Mm-hmm. And so they unhooked him from the heart monitors, took him out to the porch, he's got a heart problem, and they gave him the cocaine, which of course he enjoyed, and then brought him back and hooked him back up. In the meantime, all the medical personnel are running around because all the things are beeping. He told that story with great relish, but but after that, you know, we moved to. We decided that we needed to repair our relationship, and we were at a lot of couples, movement couples, had broken up in that year, 71, 72. Even Dave and Betty Dellinger had broken up, Nancy and Jerry had broken up, Abby had, Anita by that point was pregnant with America, but Abby had gone underground a couple of years later. So there was a definite sense of marital, or not marital, but disillusion of relationships at that moment. But Stu and I, for whatever reasons, managed to get back together. We spent a year living, at least more than a year, we spent a number of years living in the Catskills in a little mountain cabin, which was, that was the one that the FBI surveilled and broke into and so forth. But it did serve to repair our relationship. And we lived, we had a very happy and loving relationship that lasted for almost 40 years altogether, if you include the period that we were broken up. So it's, again, it's one of these long views of history thing. I mean, these times in our life were very exciting, and I remember, and I think it was very important mm-hmm. for us to break up at that moment in order for us to come back together mm-hmm. as equal partners in the relationship, because mm-hmm. we weren't beforehand. He was, the macho man, the male movement heavy, and I was, the girlfriend, mm-hmm. Except that I was more than just the girlfriend, as mm-hmm. were all the women in the Yippies and all the women in the movement. We were not simply girlfriends. We were strong mm-hmm. actors in our own right. We just didn't have the media eye, and it was a sexist culture, mm-hmm. and so we did as much or more than the men in actually organizing and creating and doing the demonstrations. We did not, however, get the credit, and that was, I think, the key to why so many relationships broke up. There was no equality. There was little equality in the relationship. When Stu and I got back together, that was one of the things that we both realized, is that in order for us to be together as a couple, we had to be able to relate to each other as equals, and we were. But he ended up, he got hepatitis C. I don't know exactly how. Before I met him, ages and ages ago, he was a welfare worker in New York, and, he would occasionally shoot up with his clients, which nobody knew back then what the outcome would be. So then 30 years, 40 years later, there he is with Hep C. I said when I spoke in People's Park for the anniversary that if you have Hep C, it's really, or you think you might have Hep C, or you think you might have been exposed to it, it's very, very important to get tested. Now, even three, and see if you have it, because there are, it's a horrible, horrible course of chemotherapy. It doesn't always work, but it can, and it can certainly prolong life. And, you know, they didn't know, they didn't, the physicians did not check Stu's liver to see if he had liver cancer. And this was, what, 3.5 years ago? And even the knowledge of the relationship of hepatitis C to liver cancer has expanded exponentially since then. So I believe, and so now if you have Hep C, I would, even if your doctor isn't telling you to get scanned for liver cancer, you absolutely, it's an absolute, I mean, I'd certainly learned this, it's an absolute must. Now, in Stu's case, even, sadly, even had they diagnosed it, they wouldn't have been able to do anything because it was, you know, so far advanced. But he had Hep C for many years. It was dormant. I don't know how long that cancer was growing. And, you know, who knows if there'd been earlier detection, earlier prevention, that life would have been different. Who knows? But after, you know, some very, very painful time for me after he died, you learn to live, you learn to go on. And in my case, I moved back here to Berkeley and met someone else, my fiancé, who lives in one of the founders of Berkeley Co-Housing. And actually, about 4 weeks ago, we went up to Portland, where Stu is buried. He's buried in the Jones Pioneer Cemetery, which I think is great because, you know, he was a pioneer in his own way. And this one part of the cemetery's got all these people from the 1800s, and the other part is this Jewish cemetery, and that's where Stu's buried. And David, my fiance, and I, and my daughter Jessica, and her now fiance Dan, all went to Stu's grave, and we sort of told him what was happening, and it felt like a little wedding ceremony for us. You know, it was like we were there and he was officiating, and we were like Rabbi Stu, he was officiating and giving us his blessing to move on. It was sad, but it was wonderful at the same time. And I think I probably have a somewhat unique perspective on things being a widow. It certainly has changed my understanding of a lot. There aren't that many of us. Jennifer Dorn, Bernadine's younger sister, is a widow, but there aren't that many of us in the movement who are. And it's a different reality. You just kind of look at things in a different way. But it was just being in the graveyard with Stu, because I can't visit him very much being down here. He's up there, but he's all around. They all are, you know. They're all up there. They're all around. You can't get away from them.
How, what, A, L, I, what a life you've had.
Yeah. It's been, well, that's why I'm writing a memoir, you know. And a number of people that I know are, which is a very good thing. Everyone has their own 60s who was there. It's not like my experience was one, someone else's experience was different. And even though we were all part of the same movement, it affected all of us and we all acted differently. And I just really think that the more people who write about it, the more, we've got to find a way to counter the 30 years of right-wing hate speech about who we were. So that's why I really encourage everyone who has a story to tell to find a way to tell it. With the internet now, it's not that hard.
A, like, on, in, S, A, N, B, San Bernardino, like in San Bernardino, there was a, J, H, J, just one, just two, three, 30 radicals, the white people were SDS and the black people were Panthers.
Right.
I and all were P R P E A peace and freedom.
Uh-huh, right. Yes, I remember peace and freedom very well, yeah.
I, well, when Frank was running for president, Gerald Sanders, who was somebody that was a Black Panther, and he lives in Oakland, but he's been on the show a number of times, and they run him for some office all the time. He's like the perennial peace and freedom for something.
Right.
And so he said, you know, you should talk to Peace and Freedom about them endorsing you.
Yeah.
And then when he found out we were Peace and Freedom, now he said, oh, you know, I T tried to get them, him, to be a running mate.
They wouldn't do it. Yeah, well, VP. You know, you just have to keep trying.
Yeah. Yeah, but they didn't want to have anything to do with Frank. Peace and freedom.
Oh, yeah, they're too straight.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think of them, I don't remember which place I wrote about them, but they're kind of white bread. That's who Peace and Freedom is, kind of white bread.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. There were countercultural communities in those days, and still some remain all across the world. In Vancouver, BC, there was a giant Yippie community that self-identified as Yippies in the late 60s and early 70s. I had no idea. I just found that out, you know, a few years ago. But all over the world, like magic mushrooms, the Yippie communities sprang up.
And I... G F O I N I find P L A places like Portland, no, P H Phoenix. Oh, like in terms of what it's like now. We did more than we do now, but go out to perform like on tours.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And,
oh, great.
And our experience is places like Phoenix,
yeah,
where before we went, people said, you're going to go do performance at Phoenix. Yeah. They drive around in pickups with guns. You know, But that they're the hungriest and the most respectful to the kind of stuff that we do, because there's just nothing there. Whereas if you go to like places like L.A.
Where you're just another, everybody wants to make it in L.A., right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not the quality of experience.
Right, right. Yeah. No, that's great. That's good. It's really good that you do that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I do have to say one thing, though, that I've been thinking about, and you tell me what you think about this, is that these days I find that my memory is... especially short-term, very deteriorating. And when Krasner was here, we had a little event at our house for him, and one of the people who was there pulled out a joint, and we all smoked it and then went on and had lunch and etc. And the next day, there was a qualitative decrease in my already poor memory, my ability to put things together. And I wonder now, if that is a negative side effect of smoking marijuana that I didn't notice back then, but I'm paying for in later life. I just wonder about that, I have to say.
No, did you say no? No.
You don't think so?
He didn't say that yet. I have not H.A. had... Frank has an incredible memory. He remembers like so much detail from forever ago.
That's great.
Yeah. But when I smoked marijuana, I F a faked getting high a lot of the time because he couldn't inhale.
Oh.
So, although didn't you say at some point they figured out blowing the smoke in your mouth, but even then it wasn't effective.
It didn't.
So, you might not be the right
to test this theory.
To test it on, right?
Well, I have to ask myself, as a moral person, right, and an ethical person, I have to ask myself if there is any kind of causal relationship, because certainly back in the day we were 100% pro marijuana, not hard drugs by any means, but pro marijuana. And
but Mikey, you didn't smoke a lot of marijuana, did you? And Mikey has no memory.
I went through one little phase, but not really.
Well, but it was just the coincidence of you know, because I haven't smoked for years, and then all of a sudden here am I, and then all of a sudden where is my immediate short-term memory? It has disappeared.
Wow.
So I'm just, it raises a question for me.
I did acid a lot. And R and E, T, etc.
Yeah.
So you did do a lot of that sort of thing.
When I was moving out of my house in Portland and packing stuff up, I came across our old 60s dope tin, right? And I looked inside it, and there were some magic mushrooms.
Whoa.
And some Tim Leary LSD.
Oh, wow.
Really old, like, you know, very old. And I said, now, what do I do with this stuff, right? What do I do with it? All of Stu's and my stuff has gone to the University of Michigan at the Labadie Collection of Social Protest. So that's where the archives are. And I said to myself, would Julie, who's our, you know, the curator there, would she want this? Nah, she wouldn't want this. It doesn't belong in the, like she keeps saying, we're a library, we're not an art, we're not a museum. And even so, they still wouldn't have wanted it. So we thought about it, and what we eventually did was we took it out to Stu's grave, and we buried it right on top of him. And I figure, you know, maybe maybe the LSD will seep down, and the mushrooms will one day sprout up for someone else who comes to visit.
Neat. I think D R drugs were I important?
Yeah, I do too, because they opened up people's consciousness and they opened people's minds to a whole different reality. There's no question that drugs were important. But it's interesting to me is what's difficult is how you talk about them and emphasize the importance and emphasize what they did, but also have perhaps now I'm finally ready at age 66 to put a cautionary note in. And that has, of course, saying nothing about a rant against the big pharma and how they rip us off, and they rip off those of us in the donut hole and those of us who, you know, who need their pharmaceuticals in order to maintain our health. That's a whole other issue.
The S, the A, I, T, R, air, the air in the 60s was F, D, different.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, the air, you mean the pollution and... Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I think... Is that... You mean like...
You mean the...
In terms of like how it would reflect in the consciousness, like that I don't know if you mean like actually physically or you mean... Maybe you do. Both? Yeah, like that... I think like the sense of like whether you thought you were part of something or not... There was like the air was different. People thought differently about things and perceived things different.
Right.
and just by kind of being alive at that time.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's why it was such an indelible experience on all of us who went through it. And that's why it's so hard to explain it to the younger generation, because they haven't gone through it.
Like I N E I never B O you you never bought drugs. Uh-huh. But no. You did plenty.
Right. Me too. Never bought them. Yeah. People gave them to you.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Free cycle.
You could H I hitchhike.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Even if you were a woman, you could hitchhike.
I hitchhiked all the time.
That's
I didn't think anything of it. When I think back about that now, I go, wow.
Yeah,
I just can't imagine. Day or night, thought nothing of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
C-R-A-S, crash at people's houses.
Right. Right. Mm. Think about how much change there has been between them and now, then and now. It is astounding, especially in these last 5 or 10 years with the internet and with people's consciousness is completely different. Because we spend so much time looking at a computer screen and so much less time interacting, and you have it's not even that. I'm not explaining this very well, but when so much is done for us by computer programs that will search and find, and when there's so much information and so much is done for us, and you compare that to what we had to do just to even make contact with people, in the days before cell phones and the days of mimeograph machines, it's just everything. There's a new revolution going on, and except that the computer programmers are in charge of it, not the humanists. And I'm a little concerned about losing the human touch in all, even with the benefits that we get from all this technology.
Yes.
There was an article about Netflix the other day in the New York Times about how they had a contest to develop a program to make it easier for people to make choices according to what their pre-programmed preferences were, which of course Netflix knew because of what
yes,
you had.
We get Netflix.
Yeah, yeah.
They're always recommending movies.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah. I want to know is, and maybe I'm just I admit to being old-fashioned on this, but where's the human connection? How where's the human connection in this? How do you get to choose an independent film as opposed to what the larger ones are? I don't know. It's
yes, N E Netflix. Is G O good at that? Oh, finding things. Yeah, that's our experience. And not just, we don't watch very many mainstream movies.
Uh-huh, but they can find the.
That's interesting.
Well, that's good to know, because I was concerned, because everyone, it seemed to me, who was involved in writing and creating these programs are men. And so I said, where is the female strength? Where's the female empathy? If you're going to be writing programs that are essentially doing some brain work for humans, I want to see both sides. I want to see the male technical skills. And not that women can't do that, because obviously they can, but in general, I just was struck by the fact that all the men were the ones who were writing all the programs, and I want to know, where are the women, and where's the woman's, where's the feminist point of view, where's the female sensibility in all this? That was my question,
and
really.
Reviews.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the other way that that we make the choices, is reading what people say about a movie.
Right.
and basing it on that.
I think that the same should happen with elections.
Yes.
No, seriously, when I lived in Oregon, you know, when I lived in Oregon, one of the good things that we did was that we had a for every election you would get a ballot, and basically you could, anyone for $500 could put a statement in the ballot, a pro or con a measure, for example, and so in say some of the anti-gay measures, there'd be all these ranting right wingers, and then someone would do a total yippee thing with $500 and write a fulminating at the mouth, completely over the top, clearly satirical thing that would be right in there, right next to the real foaming at the mouth, non-satirical ones. But you could literally look in the voter's pamphlet and see, all right, oh, I know this person, I know this person, I know this person, and they recommend this. This is good. And it was a very sort of tribal, in a sense, way of running elections, because you there were people that you would trust enough and know that they were ethical. They weren't simply being paid off. They were endorsing whatever it happened to be for the right reasons. And so you were able to use the social network to actually find out what other people felt about a particular measure. Now, I don't know if that would work here, but it certainly works for a mail-in ballot.
Mm-hmm. Who are you? Oh, tell our viewers who you are, because we're
out of time. My name is Judy Gumbo Albert. I was one of the original members of the Yippies, the Youth International Party. And to find out more, you can just go to my website, which is www.yippiegirl.com.
Like, what is my L? Oh, this is like, what's my line at the end of the
right.
show?
Right.
You find out who the person is.
Right.
Will you see? Oh, come back sometime.
I will sometime, not for a little while, because I have a wedding and a house sale and a yard sale and a bunch of other things, but maybe in the late fall or early winter.
Yes. That'd be great.
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Okay, so good night, everybody.
Great. Good night.